Well, I feel pretty inferior standing up here today. This morning I turned on the news and saw that one church in Minnesota is offering $8,000 worth of prizes, including 3D TVs and Nintendo 3D sets, game sets, to get people to come to Easter services tomorrow. They interviewed the pastor and he was very honest. He said, "That's right, I'm just bribing people to get them to come to church." Thank you. And then I saw later that another church is putting thousands of dollars into a huge Easter egg hunt, and it's highlighted by some special plastic eggs being dropped by helicopters, by a helicopter, I should say, onto the site, and they're filled with these little tickets, and the lucky kid who gets the right ticket can redeem it for a prize. So Dee looks at me and she says, "So what are you doing for everybody?" And then my answer was, Well, I did a little research, and I found out that $8,000 is nothing. Last year, there was a mega church in Corpus Christi, Texas, called the Bay Area Fellowship, and they, for Easter, allowed people to register for $4 million worth of prizes that people had donated. This is a big church, and he has a web ministry, apparently, and people all over donated for this. $4 million in exchange for attending Easter services. The pastor, it said, spreads his ministry's message nationally each weekend. With the Easter week upon us, his message is getting an even bigger boost with a big giveaway. Now, here are the prizes. We've got two BMWs. We have an Audi. We have an Avalanche, and we have a Mitsubishi Eclipse and a Jaguar, said Trish Frazier, a spokesman for the church. From dresser drawers to cars, bedroom sets to bikes, the total giveaway is valued at $4 million. The goal initially was to give away $1 million in prizes, but they had so many people donate enough money that they would do this. Our hope is someone that's never been here, that may come for the wrong reasons, comes here and we're able to plant a seed, explained Frazier. That seed, they hope, will increase membership. You get the free gift of heaven if you just accept Christ, said pastor and founder Cornelius. Of course, this generated a lot of controversy within the religious world of whether that was appropriate to do or not. So I said I feel pretty inferior. That didn't last too long. That's not the kind of news report that I really want to be involved in. In fact, it makes me happy that I don't have to do that for a living in an attempt to get people to come in the church door. Why would people do that, though, brethren? Well, frankly, we are in the time of the year, the season that is considered by most people of the Christian and the Jewish faith to be the most religious time of the year. For a lot of people, between Easter and Christmas, many of them would say Easter is far more important than Christmas is as far as its religious significance. When you go back to the day when the church began, in the early church in those years, they didn't have issues like this to deal with. They didn't have Easter eggs. That came into vogue some 500 years ago, depending on which version of history you read. But they had other issues. They had some issues back then that we don't face today. One of the problems that they faced that you read about in the New Testament was that in many of the cities of the Gentile world, you could go down to the meat market, and in the meat market, just to do your weekly shopping, you would very possibly come across meat that had been sacrificed in the idol's temple. And that became an issue in the early church that caused some religious challenge. They sold meat that had been sacrificed to idols. And in the religions of the day, the belief was that you should share some of the sacrificial meat with the general public. And so they would include it in their celebrations, in their sacrifices, in their religious observances. Then they would donate a lot of it to the local meat market or sell it to the local meat market, whatever, and there it would be sold to the general public. Many of the pagans who came out of those religions and that God called into the church understood the significance of the religious background to it, because there were religions that taught that if you ate that meat, the gods would actually join you in that meal. So this caused a bit of a problem for some. At some point in the feast, you've probably been to 1 Corinthians chapter 10, looking at verses 16 and 17. In fact, we quoted it at the Passover. It is specifically mentioning there about the bread and the wine. And when we take this bread and the wine, it's a communion with one another and with Jesus Christ. In looking at those two verses, you might not have noticed that it is in the context of a discussion about this very thing, about eating meat that had been sacrificed to idols. Now, it's a long explanation, and I'm not going to go through the whole context. That's not my point there. But Paul was generally saying that, look, don't participate in the religious practices. But if you want to eat the meat that's sold down at the meat market, I will give you the non-theological explanation that I heard one time, that what Paul was essentially saying, condensed down into a non-theological way, it's just a piece of meat. That's all it is. It's just a piece of meat. But on the other hand, he said, if it offends a brother, if there's a brother who has a conscience issue over it, don't eat it. Don't make your brother stumble over something like that, and don't cause offense. So, you know, you can get the whole explanation of it. Sometimes people try to twist that to mean that you can eat whatever meats you want to, but the context was about eating meat sacrificed to idols. We don't have that today. They didn't have Easter eggs back then. But one thing we do have in common is that the grocery stores made a pretty good business off of things religious. Back then they did. Back now we do. Now, with that on my mind, the other day I dropped into a local to be unnamed supermarket. And I decided to survey what was in the marketplace today that is being promoted at this very religious time of the year. Most times around Easter and Christmas, I try to do like most of you, just ignore it, go in and get your stuff and get out. But this time I went specifically with the purpose of looking over the merchandise. You ought to do it sometime. It's amazing what you find in there. I had my little piece of paper and I was making a list. Of course, there are baskets. There are real baskets. There are plastic baskets. There are plain that you can fix yourself, and there are those that are prepackaged and already designed into elaborate gift baskets. You have to have fake grass to put in the baskets, so there's the grass. That's the plastic grass that is provided. There are ribbons and there are bows with Easter themes, things like that on them. Stuffed toys of all sizes, predominantly rabbits, of course, some chickens and things like that. Eggs of all sizes. Now, I'm talking plastic and metal eggs primarily, even wooden eggs. But they're painted, many of them, with various scenes, and most of them are shiny and pretty. There's stuff to decorate your eggs. There's dye and paint and decals and designs. They had rabbit-shaped cake pans. So if you're into making a cake, you can do it in the shape of a rabbit. Candy galore. This is a dentist must be conflicted. I mean, it's a tragic thing, but it sure probably puts them in the dental chair later on. Lots of chocolates, molds by which you can make your own candy. Those nasty little marshmallow bunnies that, I don't know, I know people like them. I can still, from the time I was a little child, I still remember the texture and the taste, and I thought they were yucky then, and they're yucky to look at now. Jelly beans, of course, Little Debbie Easter cakes, even Rice Krispie Treat bunny molds. So you can make Rice Krispie bunnies now, Rice Krispie Treat bunnies. You go to the card section, cards galore, serious cards, funny cards, religious cards for every family member, you know, and friends that you would come across. Snow globes. I found snow globes for Easter. Balloons, of course, and flowers. Many displays, many of them featuring lilies. I hate it when they call them Easter lilies because they weren't created that way. They were just created as lilies. But, of course, you have them. Cardboard cutouts of all sorts of decorations, some quite large, and again, specializing in rabbits. I was really disappointed not to find something that I saw a couple of years ago in another store. It was a string of Easter lights. Just like Christmas lights, except the lights were in the shape of different colored eggs. But you were to string them around your house or, I don't know, no trees to put them on at that time of the year. Put them wherever you want to, I guess, but they were bulbs decorated like Easter eggs. Easter-shaped dog food. Nah, I'm kidding on that one. But I thought, you know, going through there, I saw so much other stuff, and I said, some marketer someday is going to say, let's get Fido in on the fun and, you know, make some little egg-shaped dog treats that he can sniff out in the yard on Sunday morning. You know, you just expect it to come. Because all over the store, there was so much merchandise. There was the main display, and then at the front of the rows and at the back end of the rows, the specialty items. It was just all over. I hope it does not offend anybody, but I purchased one of these items today specifically to bring here. I did not purchase it to be a part of our worship services, but to use it in a context, to make a point, sort of like the time when Paul was in the middle of Athens and he used his observation, turn to Acts 17, he used his observation of some religious practices in order to make a point of his own in Acts 17. When you think about it, this was a brilliant way to approach people. In Acts 17 and verse 22, it says, Paul stood in the middle of the Areopagus and said, men of Athens, I perceive that in all things you are very religious. He wasn't criticizing them. He was just making an observation. It was a very religious society. For as I was passing through and considering the objects of your worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, to the unknown God. Therefore, the one whom you worship without knowing, him I proclaim to you. In 1972, I had the chance to stand on Mars Hill at the Areopagus, which is what the Areopagus is, right below the Parthenon, and you can look right down on the place there where the temple lies in ruins. And there are to this day columns lying over in the grass, and they explained that on these columns were the various statues of the different gods. And it's really amazing to be standing on that spot with your Bible open, looking down there and thinking it might have been that column or that column that had this statue to the unknown God. It really makes the Bible come alive. And he said, God who made the world and everything in it, since he is the Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands, nor is he worshipped with men's hands, as though he needed anything, since he gives to all life, breath, and all things. And he has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth, and has determined their pre-appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation, so that they should seek the Lord in the hope that they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from every one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. As also some of your own poets have said, for we are also his offspring. The Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown commentary has a pretty interesting note. It says, Paul quoted the first half of the fifth line, word for word, of an astronomical poem by Aratus, who was a poet about three centuries before Paul. Paul was a very educated man. Therefore, verse 29, since we are the offspring of God, we ought not to think that the divine nature is like gold or silver or stone, something shaped by art and man's devising. Truly, these times of ignorance God overlooked, but now commands all men everywhere to repent, because he has appointed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by the man whom he has ordained. He has given assurance of this to all by raising him from the dead. So we are to think about Christ being raised from the dead, and there are sermons involved in that all by themselves. But Paul was going through there, and he observed considering the objects of their worship. And so that's sort of what I was doing the other day, considering the objects, the religious trappings that go with this religious holiday of Easter. And all the stuff there is woven deeply into the religious worship. Now, I know there are those who would object, saying Easter is not about rabbits and it is not about eggs. But if it wasn't for Easter, we wouldn't have this stuff in the store. It wouldn't be there. And so those who observe it must be a little conflicted themselves on saying, if it's not about it, then why is it here? Because if it wasn't for Easter, we would not have these things. We wouldn't have the rabbits. We wouldn't have the eggs. Churches will hold Easter egg hunts on their grounds after services tomorrow. And as many people gather to honor the one who is risen from the dead, the one who said, keep the commandments, of which is one of those that says, do not lie. We will turn right around and tell our children these eggs came from rabbits. And are for those who are good little boys and girls. He also said, you shall not covet, which makes you question the ethics of offering door prizes to people to show up for church by appealing to their covetous nature. I will come to church because I have a chance at winning a car or maybe something much less, a 3D TV. We'll pack the churches. Is it God's will to appeal to people's covetous nature to bring them to Christ? Is that the way he would do it? Well, people can say we don't worship these things, but they are inextricably woven into the religious worship, and it's conflicting. So while I was in the market, I bought one item to use as an illustration for you today, a symbol of something. Exhibit A for today's sermon, a chocolate, for those of you in the back hall out of sight, a chocolate bunny. What does this rabbit symbolize? Now, you would be correct to tell me the story about where it came from and its origins in ancient worship. Look at that. It's missing one eye. that's how things get marketed. Put the good eye on the customer side of things. Where are those wet cloths? I'm going to need them. Melts in your hand, not in your mouth. Well, you know, this is a rabbit. You would be correct to say, well, that represents some old pagan concepts of fertility symbols. But I want you to think of something different. There's something very different, thank you, that this will symbolize as well that I'm going to bring out just a little bit later on. I also bought something else there. This wasn't so easy to find. Now, this thing I had to choose from a multitude of different types. The other thing was not easy to find. I was pretty sure it was in the store. It had to be in the store somewhere, but it must have taken me 10 minutes to find it. I walked up and down aisles, every aisle except the cleaning supplies and the dog food, and I was just about to go down those. And I finally found it on aisle 5 on my third trip down aisle 5. I really slowed down and was looking hard and finally spotted it. I don't know why I didn't look at aisle 5 first. I mean, the little sign said, this is the aisle for ketchup, mayonnaise, mustard, and what was the other thing? Salad dressing. Thanks again. Keeping the sergeant at arms really hopping here today. For some reason, I started looking in the bread section. Then I went to crackers. It wasn't in any of those places. Then I just started going up and down aisles until I finally found it. My eye fell on it. It was located just a little bit above my head next to the olives of all places. Recognize this? Unleavened bread, matzos. So for exhibit B, this is also a symbol used in religious worship. A piece of unleavened bread. Oops, that was broken. Let's see. Maybe we'll put them somewhere they can stay in your visibility. Actually, my search originated with the thought in mind of looking at the symbolism in these things, but the search itself had symbolism. The search itself had symbolism. I could not help but think that even the location in the store of these items is symbolic. The very thing that God says to use as a symbol of religious worship is relegated to a place that's almost impossible to find it. I had to search for it. Whereas the things that are used that came directly from polytheistic and secular worship are elevated to prominent places, and you walk in the store and it jumps at you. I mean, it's right there. So even that was symbolic. But, you know, look at these two things in terms of appearance. Many people would see these in totally contrasting ways today. You know, you could look at it and say, the old way versus the new way. That's one way to look at it. Dull and bland versus exciting and pretty and fun. Some might even say Old Testament, New Testament. Not that this is in the New Testament, but in the New Testament, hey, you've got freedom to do this stuff. That may be the way some would say it. Some would say Jewish versus Christian. Again, freedom. You'd have to look at this and say, man, modern Christianity has sure made improvements on a lot of stuff, hasn't it? It might have been okay back in the days of the Exodus, but you need more pizzazz today if you're going to make this work. It's okay. It's not my only one. But I mean, brethren, how can this compete with this? I mean, how's it going to compete in the mind of a child or even in the mind of most adults? You know, you just look at these two things and you just see something that's just totally, totally different. No wonder people came up with better ways to do things, right? You had to come up with something better. Just further observations. How does this look? This is cute. It's adorable. Makes you think of a fuzzy little rabbit. This is not cute. This is not cute. Doesn't have any buck teeth. Doesn't have any, you know, little fuzzy. I tried to make it cute. Took a magic marker to it. I wouldn't eat this one, but probably remind you of SpongeBob SquarePants. That's about it. Taste? I mean, it's chocolate. This is dough and water, flour and water. If you get lucky, your mom may get you some egg and onion, spice it up. But I mean, chocolate versus flour and water. How are you going to compete with those? And what do we tell kids? What's the story? This, man, this has a lot of exciting. This is fantasy. This is about rabbits and laying eggs and all that kind of stuff and treats and all that. This, the story behind this is slavery, plagues, firstborn dying, leaving some place that kids don't even know about called Egypt. You know, how can a child relate to something like this? I mean, the comparisons are pretty tough. These even get personalized. They get names. Peter Cottontail, you know, that's a name. Everybody identifies with names. Nobody's ever stuck a name on one of these. You ever hear stories about Mickey Matzo? You know, it just doesn't work. It just, it's not there. So, you know, it's a marketing issue that really the old way has a lot to compete with, and it's just not going to, it's not going to sell real well, you know, in many ways. Which would appeal to most people? Hunt for eggs and candy, or hunt for leavening while you work to clean the house? And de-leavening is work. The kitchen, the cabinets, the car, the garage, everything. The vacuuming, the sweeping, the dusting. Which is more fun? Wash eggs and get them ready to die and have a hunt? Or wash feet? Which is more enjoyable? Take chocolate to school with you in your lunch? Or take, as I used to when I was in high school, a matzo and peanut butter sandwich? And have your kids, your friends there go, what? What is that? Oh, matzo and peanut butter. Which is considered most enjoyable for people, to go to church once on Easter Sunday morning for a half hour, 45 minutes, or to go four times plus the Passover in the space of 8 days for 2 hours at a shot? You know, on the surface, no wonder that matzos are relegated to an obscure position in the middle of aisle five. You know, this, they do not represent a lot of things that a lot of people would like. Get that stuff out of here. That's old-fashioned for the, you know, for people who want to hold on to that old stuff. I said it's on the surface. You remember I told you a few minutes ago the rabbit was symbolic of something that may not normally come to mind. Besides just its origins, it is symbolic of what is on the surface versus what is inside. A few nights ago, we took bread like this and we broke it at the Passover. I'm going to take this chocolate rabbit and I'm going to break it. We're going to break it for the symbolism. You know what's inside this rabbit? Nothing. It's hollow. Precisely. That's the symbolism. It is hollow. What is symbolic about this bread? What is the symbolism behind this bread? Well, if you go into the story of the bread, the significance of it has some of the most compelling history in all of man's experiences. What has to do with the history of that bread and why we have it today is something that changed the course of the whole world. It goes back for thousands of years. It begins a whole lot earlier than the account of this command to keep a feast of unleavened bread. It goes back to a time when God made a promise to people who were going to be the ancestors of a nation called Israel, Abraham and his wife Sarah, and he promised them that they would have a child. And out of that child would come a great nation, and that nation would become dominant in the world. And the promises made to Abraham, though, were not just physical, though. They had great spiritual implications, and they had symbolism themselves of the kingdom of God. And as time went on, the centuries rolled by, the story took a lot of turns, and it finally ended up where these people ended up for four centuries plus in this place called Egypt, and they moved from being guests to being slaves, and their lives were in bondage, and it was harsh and cruel. And we come to a place in Exodus 12 where God was going to deliver them, and he was going to miraculously bring them out, and at the same time strike at Egypt through the death of their firstborn. And God instructed them at the same time, in that same chapter, he said, now, from this point on, after you sacrifice this lamb, each household, and you smear the blood on the doorpost, and that death angel will pass over you, and you will be spared from this plague, you will also begin, from this point on, observing a feast. It'll be a feast of unleavened bread. And he explained a lot of it in chapter 12. In chapter 13, let's turn here. God again speaks to Moses about the significance of this feast. In Exodus 13, in verse 3, we're going to read some things here that tell us about the substance of this feast. What is it all about? Is it a hollow observation, or does it have some depth of meaning? It is no less important for us today than it was for them. In fact, because of the spiritual substance, it is more important for us today than it was for them. In verse 3, Moses said to the people, "Remember this day in which you went out from Egypt, out of the house of bondage." This is one of the core lessons from this feast. It is a time to remember where we came from and remember how we came out. It's a time for us, brethren, to remember how God called us. How did he call us? How did he bring us here? What is your story? How did he bring you to this point? Where were you in life? Where were you going? What were you doing? What did you know of God? What were you a slave to? What was that slavery doing to your life? What was your Egypt? What was your Egypt? Because we all lived there. What is it that you were in bondage to? What was sin doing to your life? What would life be like for you now if God had totally left you alone? If none of this had happened, where would you be? What would you be doing? What would you have hope for? Keep your finger here in Exodus 13. Let's go to Romans 6. Romans chapter 6. In verse 17. "But God be thanked that though you were slaves of sin, yet you obeyed from the heart that form of doctrine to which you were delivered." God brought you out, delivered you, and he did it through an understanding of truth in a time when we were enslaved. "And having been set free from sin, you became slaves of righteousness. I speak in human terms because of the weakness of your flesh. For just as you presented your members as slaves of uncleanness and of lawlessness, leading to more lawlessness, so now present your members as slaves of righteousness for holiness. For when you were slaves of sin, you were free in regard to righteousness. What fruit did you have then in the things of which you are now ashamed? For the end of those things is death. But now, having been set free from sin and having become slaves of God, you have your fruit to holiness and the end, everlasting life." That means something. That's a statement of substance for life. "For the wages of sin is death, but the gift of God is eternal life in Christ Jesus our Lord." There was a time when we remember what it was like to be in Egypt and to leave and to go out of the house of bondage. Back to Exodus 13 and verse 3. Exodus 13 verse 3. "It is a time to consider that for by strength of hand the Lord brought you out of this place." How did we come here? How did we come to be here? Well, it was only one way. It was by strength of hand, not our own, but of God's doing. What kind of strength did it take for God to deliver us? Now, for the Israelites, they saw a long string of physical miracles, spectacular things that nobody could explain. Some of us have seen some physical miracles in our lives too. But for all of us, we've seen the spiritual miracles, even more powerful than things physical. Things that happen that are beyond the typical human comprehension, that we don't see these things on a human level. But it says, first of all, it was the strength of the hand of the Lord. As we've considered the Passover in these days, we saw the strength of the hand of the Lord. And put a bookmarker here in Exodus 13, we'll be back. But we've seen it in John, what is said here in John 3. In John 3, verse 16, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son." What kind of strength does that take? The power of love? We sing about the power of love in the human term, but there's nothing in the human level that compares to this kind of love, this kind of capacity to give your only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life. For God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be saved. That's a strength of the Lord's hand that is in a different realm, that type of love. We saw the strength of the Lord in Philippians chapter 2. Philippians 2, beginning in verse 5. Philippians 2, 5. "Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who being in the form of God, did not consider it robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation." This type of humility is a strength of the Lord's hand. "Taking the form of a servant and coming in the likeness of men, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even the death of the cross." That's the strength of God's hand that made this possible for us. This type of humility, this type of obedience. We also see the strength of the hand of the Lord in terms of obedience back in Hebrews chapter 5. Hebrews chapter 5. All of these things relating to what it took to deliver us. Hebrews 5, verse 7. "Who in the days of his flesh, when he had offered up prayers and supplications, with vehement cries and tears, to him who was able to save him from death, and was heard because of his godly fear. Though he was a son, yet he learned obedience by the things which he suffered. And having been perfected, he became the author of eternal salvation to all who obey him." What kind of strength did that take? We saw the strength of the Lord's hand in Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews 12, verses 2 and 3. "Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls." Here's the strength of the hand of the Lord, who saw this, who understood this, and who looked past what he was going to have to endure and saw the future. We see the strength of the hand of the Lord in John 17 and verse 4. In John 17 and verse 4. When Jesus said in his prayer, John 17, 4, "I have glorified you on the earth. I have finished the work which you have given me to do." We see his commitment. We see his perseverance. We see that determination to live that life of work that God had given him to do. That's by the strength of the Lord. Sometimes we don't carry that same strength, do we? Just look at it on a human level and you begin to see that perfect life was a strength unparalleled. In Luke 22, we see the strength of the Lord in terms of courage. Luke 22. Luke 22 and verse 41. "That evening before his death," verse 41, Luke 22, "and he was withdrawn from them about a stone's throw, and he knelt down and prayed, saying, Father, if it is your will, remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done." He knew what it would involve. And humanly, no human wants to go through that. But his pursuit over the flesh by the Spirit of God leading him is what he operated by. "Then an angel appeared to him from heaven, strengthening him. And being in agony, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat became like great drops of blood falling down to the ground." We see the strength of the hand of the Lord when you just look at God, what He is, what He did, what He does. It's amazing. It's a time of year when we think about the strength of the hand of the Lord. And then you think about, what did He have to do to get into my thick head? The miracle of God opening a mind, calling somebody, and it taking. That's God's work. So back in Exodus 13:3, when we think about coming out of the land of Egypt, and how we did it, and what is involved in the strength of the hand of the Lord that brought us out of this place, we have a basis then for understanding that no leavened bread shall be eaten, because leavening is a symbol of sin and of bondage. In chapter 12, when it tells the story here, verse 34, Exodus 12:34, we read a couple of statements here. It says, "So the people took their dough before it was leavened, having their kneading bowls bound up in their clothes on their shoulders. They were told, 'Get out.' And they had their chance, and they had to get out. And in verse 39, it says, 'They baked unleavened cakes of the dough which they had brought out of Egypt. For it was not leavened, because they were driven out of Egypt and could not wait, nor had they prepared provisions for themselves.'" So they grabbed this unleavened bread. They didn't have time to sit there and wait for it to rise. Grab what you have and leave. And so He took that and He said, "You keep this feast from now on, and you keep this unleavened bread, and it will remind you of all of this." But more importantly, it reminds us of the whole process of leaving Egypt. No leavening shall be eaten. In verse 4 says, "On this day you're going out in the month Abib." Now, going out was a process. They weren't just supernaturally transported. They weren't, it wasn't like, name slipping me, not Elijah, Enoch, yeah. It wasn't like that. They had to get up, put their shoes on, and walk out of there and carry everything with them. It was a process of leaving. We are in a process of leaving too. It was a journey. Today we are sojourning in this world, and it is a journey to leave sin, but we got up and we are getting out. We have to go. You're going out in the month of Abib. "And it shall be, when the Lord brings you into the land of the Hittites," or sorry, "the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, which He swore to your fathers to give you, a land flowing with milk and honey, that you shall keep this service in this month." It is so important to keep this service in this month. Now, there's a lot in this verse. God is bringing us to a promised land. The milk flowing with the land flowing with milk and honey became a phrase. It became a statement that was a term to describe the blessings of life as God intended, what God would do for people. These people were going on faith. They'd never been there. They'd never been out of Egypt. They had seen no other life than what they had seen in slavery. So they were going out unknown. They did not know where they were going. All they had was a promise, but they were willing to go. We have not yet seen the kingdom of God, except in the mind's eye. We have the prophecies. We have a lot given to us to give us visuals in the mind's eye. But we've not been there. But we're on our way, aren't we? And we are going in faith, because we have come to a point of believing it doesn't matter how good this world is. This isn't it. This isn't what we want. It's not what we need. There's got to be something better than this. And despite living in one of the greatest places on earth, we look around and we say, this still isn't it. Still looking for something more. This isn't what God intended. There's another lesson in this, though. They were leaving Egypt. But where were they going? They were not going into an unoccupied territory. They were going into the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Jebusites, the Amorites, all of these people. Those were going to be enemies. Those enemies were going to have to be displaced. And Israel was going to learn some important lessons as they were to go on this journey. On the night that Christ died, He prayed, and He said these words, "I do not pray that you take them out of the world, but that you keep them from the evil. As you have sent me into the world, I have also sent them into the world." It sure be nice, wouldn't it, if we could just have a little colony somewhere, just us. The world didn't know we were around. It would be perfect, wouldn't it? No, it wouldn't be perfect, because we'd be there. It's like they say, if you're ever looking for the perfect church, don't join it, because then it won't be perfect anymore. No, we couldn't have the perfect colony if it was just us. But boy, it would sure be nice not to have to wrestle in the world all the time. It's like going to the Feast of Tabernacles. You get a little taste for 8 days of when you're little. It's just different. But God didn't say, I'm going to pull you out and isolate you somewhere. He said, I'm sending you into the world, and it's there you're going to have to fight your enemies. And I'll fight them for you, as he told Israel. But that's where we're at. In verse 6, he said, 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. Now, as it was mentioned in the sermonette, we spend these 7 days thinking about two things when it comes to bread. Don't eat the wrong stuff and eat the good stuff. You know, your mind is on what to keep out, and then your mind is on what do I eat. And that's good. In those things are lessons. Lessons of substance. Lessons of life. Every time we think about, don't do that. Every time you drive through Taco Bell and you think, okay, I can get the crunchy tacos, but I can't get the soft ones. You're aware. It's because you're aware of something. It's an object lesson in awareness. Why don't we think that way when it comes to sin? Why don't we just think that way when it comes to sin? Don't let that in. That's good stuff. You can have that. Why aren't we as diligent when it comes to sin? But that's the object lesson. It's a good object lesson. So he says, there will be no leavened bread eaten. Don't bring it with you. But then he says here during this feast, 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. And on the seventh day there shall be a feast to the Lord. Unleavened bread shall be eaten 7 days, and no leavened bread shall be seen among you, nor shall leaven be seen in all your quarters. This is a tremendous lesson in substance. Because when you put together all of the rest of what we've learned since their time, what is in the New Testament, we understand some things about bread they never understood. Let's go to John 6. Again, keep your finger here in Exodus 13. In John 6, Jesus gave a message that offended people, caused people to stumble. It was a message so strong that it says in verse 66, from that time, many of his disciples went back and walked with him no more. They couldn't take it. They could not figure out what he was saying. In John 6:48, he said, I am the bread of life. Your fathers ate the manna in the wilderness and are dead. It was miraculous, manna was, and it kept them alive when they had nothing, but it didn't save their lives forever. This is the bread which comes down from heaven, that one may eat of it and not die. I am the living bread which came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread that I shall give is my flesh, which I shall give for the life of the world. The Jews therefore quarreled among themselves, saying, how can this man give us his flesh to eat? Totally distracted onto the wrong point. Then Jesus said to them, most assuredly, you want to hear more? Unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you. That introduced some things that was just totally, when they misunderstood it, didn't grasp what he was saying. But that blood, represented by that wine that we took at the Passover, has to do with a covenant that we make with God. Eating of his flesh has to do with living like he lived, being like him, him living in us. Whoever eats my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life, and I will raise him up at the last day. For my flesh is food indeed, and my blood is drink indeed. He who eats my flesh and drinks my blood abides in me, and I in him. As the living Father sent me, and I live because of the Father, so he who feeds on me will live because of me. This is the bread which came down from heaven, not as your fathers ate the manna and are dead. He who eats this bread will live forever. That's pretty heavy. That's substance. That's substance. Now, eating this piece of bread tonight at our meal won't make you righteous any more than eating a piece of chocolate makes me sinful. Eating unleavened bread can mean no more than eating a bunny ear, a chocolate, piece of chocolate, if you don't put your mind on what it's all about. But if we do put our mind on what it's all about, the meaning deepens more and more every year as we grow in a converted mind and an understanding. The depth of John 6 gets deeper and deeper as we consider the symbolism of that bread. Symbols are useful only if the significance of the meaning is deeply explored and examined. But for those who do think on these things, this feast becomes life-changing. The meaning of this feast changes your life. Back to Exodus 13. Exodus 13, verse 8. I'd like for you to think about it, parents especially. And for those of you who are parents-to-be somewhere, now's the time to fix in your mind some of the things you're going to do in terms of raising your children. It's interesting what he says in regard to the observance of this feast and family life. He says, "And you shall tell your son in that day, saying, 'This is done because of what the Lord did for me when I went up from Egypt.'" Very specifically, in this feast, he says, I want you to tell your children about it. And I want you to explain to them, talk to the children. In verse 3, he told the people, remember what it was like. A child cannot remember what they have never experienced. But a child can remember what you've told them about your experiences. Children learn through stories. Children learn through explaining. And he says, tell your son in that day, this is done. The reason we're doing this, is because of what the Lord did for me when I came up from Egypt. I don't remember if it was at church recently or if it was in conversation with someone after church a couple of weeks ago that I mentioned to them about my wife and the first time that her father brought her to the Passover with him. She was about 15. She was the oldest of five kids, and so to have a little personal time with Dad was a rare treat, you know. And after the Passover, he brought her to watch and observe. And then afterwards, they went to a little place and, you know, got a cup of coffee and hot chocolate or something, spent some time. And she said, my father explained to me the whole story of how he came into the church and why that foot washing and why the bread and the wine was so important to him. He explained things that she'd never heard about, the whole story, I guess. But it was one-on-one. And he talked to her about why this was so important. And it had a lasting impression on her. That's important for our children. And it's so important that God included that in the instructions. Talk to them. Tell them. Explain your story. Every time I read this verse, I think of Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young song from about 68 or somewhere in there. You know, sometimes you hear a song and it just takes you back and you put yourself, you have a memory of where you were. And I can remember driving down the road at 5:30 in the morning, down the loop around Houston, going to my summer job. And Teach Your Children was on the radio every morning. That was when it was popular, 1969. Teach Your Children. And the song says, you who are on the road must have a code that you can live by. And so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children. Their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the ones they pick, the one you know by. Well, you know, we are on the road. We're on the road of a way of life. We're on the road to salvation, and we have a code that we live by, that God has given us. And the past, you know, every year at the Passover, we think about the past as just a goodbye. But we remember it, and we are to teach our children well. And we're to tell them, you know, the hell we were in did go by. It's gone. It's behind us. We're leaving it. And fix them on your dreams. I like that phrase. Fix them on your dreams. Help them see. Help paint the picture for them of what this is all about. And maybe they will fix that dream and your dream will be shared of God's kingdom. So important. Explain to them the story of how you or their grandparents or maybe their great-grandparents. We're getting to fourth and fifth generation kids now. They need to know the story of how the family came out of Egypt. They need to know how they came to be here. They need to have impressed upon them at this time of the year in a feast which is about sincerity and truth. It's a great time to talk about object lessons of truth, how important truth is, how the world lies, how the world deceives, how the world can paint things up in a very nice way, but it tricks. And it lures people into sin. And then the consequences of sin. Explanations that relate. Put the time into thinking about it. Teaching the truth about how to live. Connecting their lives to what has happened in the past. These people we're reading about here in Exodus 12 and 13 and 14 and all through here. These are our ancestors. This is where they came from. The people in the early New Testament church. That's our link to the past. We are connected to the past. When people have a connection to life, when they have us, when they see their place in the whole scheme of things, it helps enlarge their purpose and meaning. It helps them move from just living day to day and just picking up on whatever comes. And our young people live today in a world that teaches very subtly, but it's there all the time. There is no absolute truth, and there is no real meaning of life. What's the purpose of life? One of the greatest faults of evolution, besides that it teaches there is no God, is that it teaches you there is no purpose. There is no purpose. We must have purpose. And purpose gives your life substance. It's so important to teach about these things. What is happening on the earth in the time past, and where they are right now in the future, in the present, and where we're going to be in the future. These things children can learn at age-appropriate levels. Teach them about that. Help give them understanding and wisdom. What can, for example, God's feast give you? Young people, what can God's feast give you that you can't get anywhere else? Nowhere else. God's feast. They can give you an understanding of how life works. This feast itself is all about how life works. When you understand sin and when you understand righteousness, you can't help but think about those things and go into conversations about cause and effect. It works this way because. It doesn't work this way because. That's the nature of sin versus righteousness. It gives you such a head start on everybody else around you. A young person who understands sin, man, they have a head start on life. They have a head start on life that just that understanding alone will keep them from getting trapped and enslaved in so many things that people finally, they eventually see themselves sucked into. It gives an insight on life in a very special way. You can teach your children that they too can have a special relationship with God. He looks to and he honors those who obey him. He enters their life in a very interesting way. And God won't lie to you. God won't lie to you. The world will, but God won't lie to you. He's not going to tell you things that aren't right. He'll tell you the truth. God will give you the strength to be different too. The strength of the Lord's hand is not just to take us out of Egypt. It lives with us wherever we are. His hand will be with you too. When I was a teenager, I found this little saying on a placemat, of all places, in a Pizza Hut one time. It was on a placemat, and it stuck with me forever, and it said, "Never be afraid to stand with the minority when the minority is right, because someday the minority that is right will be in the majority." And God's way is right, and you may be minority now. And it may be a little strange sometimes, like I was telling you, to sit down at the lunch table and somebody asks, "What in the world are you eating?" Matzo and peanut butter. But it doesn't matter. I can look at them and say, "You'll be eating it one day too." And you know what? It's not so bad. You learn to like it. Keeping the days of unleavened bread helps you understand righteousness, helps you understand choices in life, helps you make the right choices. It's a great blessing. Verse 9. "It shall be as a sign to you on your hand and as a memorial between your eyes, that the Lord's law may be in your mouth. For with a strong hand, the Lord has brought you out of the land of Egypt," out of Egypt. Keeping this way of life annually helps us remember the way of God. It keeps it as a sign on your hand, your actions, and a memorial between your eyes, signifying your thinking, so that God's way is in your mind. This is the substance. This is the substance that comes from this little symbol of unleavened bread. When you go back through verses 3 through 9 and you consider, you go into detail things that I've just touched on the surface about today. Go into detail on that and you will see this is substance, because this is the stuff that changes your life. This is the substance of life. Every life, nobody's exempt. Every day, day in, day out, from now on until eternity. It is not hollow. This is filled with meaning. This is filled with life-changing material. Now, brethren, I know that most Christians today would tell you that Easter is not hollow either. The ultimate proof of anything, though, whether it's the days of unleavened bread, or whether it's Easter or Christmas or anything else, doesn't matter what religion, what holy day, what way of life, the ultimate proof is in people's lives. God's life, God's way changes people if we eat of that bread. If we follow that, it will do it. God's way will change this world one person at a time, because it is deep, it is very personal, It has to do with an individual resolving to keep sin out, who does so in the light of the sacrifice of Christ and a commitment to live according to the way that he lived. That's depth. It's not form. It's substance. It's not form. It's substance. But we can keep the days of unleavened bread with form too, you know. I've known of people who've kept the Passover symbols with form and no substance. And it can mean nothing more to us than a piece of chocolate. I know that one of the rules of public speaking says that all analogies break down. And I know that someone could say, well, you can go to the store and buy some solid chocolate bunnies too. You know, solid chocolate. They're not that big. They're in the little variety. And so not everything is symbolically hollow. And I know that many serious Christians today would tell you that Easter is not about rabbits. And many serious Christians are disgusted in the same way we might be about how those things have carried over into religion today. But even if somebody is disgusted by it, they have to still answer another question. It's not just those trappings of religion that you can buy in the grocery store. You have to ask, why is it that the festivals of God, the festivals that he instituted that are so rich in meaning, read Exodus 13 again as we've just read here. Does that not have meaning for us? Is it not relevant? Why have these been abandoned? Why have God's festivals been traded out? Why have they been traded out? To the point that most people today, even in the religious world, don't even know what the days of unleavened bread are. Go down tomorrow and take a poll. Take an exit poll as people are coming out of church and say, have you ever heard of the days of unleavened bread? And I would bet you the vast majority would say, nope. What are you talking about? Why have they been traded out? In the process, so much spiritual substance has been lost, and that's a sad thing. If we were living today, instead of in 2011, if we were living sometime between 30 and 70 AD, in the area of Jerusalem and around the Mediterranean, into Asia Minor, if we had been called into the church after the day of Pentecost in 31 AD, we would be learning about these new symbols, the bread and the wine. Those were new things that were brought into the church by the apostles. We would be learning to commemorate not only the leaving of Egypt, as we, if we were Jews, we would have known about, but we would be commemorating the death of Jesus Christ. We would be keeping a time that would have deeper significance than ever before. Ever before. But we would not be abandoning the Feast of Unleavened Bread. We would not be trading one for the other. We would be adding to what we were observing at the Feast of Unleavened Bread. After the Passover, we would be going directly into that feast, just as had been done over 1,400 years before us. We would still continue putting out leavening. If you were Gentile, you'd be learning about putting out leavening. If you were Jewish, you'd be continuing what you'd done. But the church, Jew or Gentile, would still be putting out leavening. They would still be eating unleavened bread. But now we would be learning about the meaning of that unleavened bread too. Deeper meaning than we ever had before. How it symbolized the substance of the daily life of Jesus Christ, his perfection, his perfect life, his way to live, and the resulting substance in our daily lives. We would see the Passover. We would not forget about the Exodus, of course. We would learn about that and what God did for Israel. But we would now be learning about how Christ is our Passover. We would be taking on an entirely new dimension of depth of understanding. We would be considering, because of the examination spiritually going into Passover, the substance of our daily lives. What is our substance? What needs to change? We would be focused on that. We would consider the words that we read earlier in John 6. We'd be thinking about, this leads to eternal life. This is not just here and now for this week. What I am doing is something that has to do with eternal life. And we'd be pondering that. We'd be thinking about that. And when we eat that dough and water mix that produces unleavened bread, we would be thinking of him. When you eat this, we're supposed to think of him. Pray tell, what does gorging ourselves on eggs and candy and Easter ham do for making people think of him? Where's the substance in it? If you took that tomorrow and said, okay, explain to me the substance of that as it relates to Jesus Christ, it'd be a short story. There just wouldn't be much. Yes, if we had been in the early church, the one built on the foundation of the prophets and apostles, that's what we would be doing. That's what we would be thinking. Nearly 2,000 years later, we're not in the early church, but we are still holding the observances of the early church. As we've sometimes described it, we are the first century church in the 21st century. And that's something that we believe is very important, because the spiritual applications are timeless. They are just as real today in 2011 as they were in 31 AD, because humans are just the same. Humans are just the same. Same nature, same approach, same societal issues that we deal with. But brethren, today, for those of us keeping these days, it's very important, because you cannot be a person of substance if your attention and emphasis is on the hollow things. We cannot be people of substance if our attention is on hollow things. That's why the Passover and the days of unleavened bread hold substance for us. That's why they are not hollow. This dull, unexciting, bland, commercially not very viable, can't dress it up in ads to make it sexy, you know. This stuff is full of meaning. This is full of meaning. Absolutely full. This bread connects us with our past, going back thousands of years ago, to what God did to work to change history. It connects us to the life of Jesus Christ in its meaning, who came to give his life as that bread from heaven. It connects us to the present, making us mindful every day of the stark contrast between the meaning of leavening of sin and the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth and which way to live. I, for one, and I think all of us, look forward to the day when we'll have a chance to change the grocery store displays. And we'll have a chance to not only change the grocery store displays, but to teach. When church and religion and everything will have a totally different point of view. We won't have to bribe people to go to church one day in hopes that maybe if we get them there, even if it's the wrong reason, a little seed will take hold. I'm going to conclude with a verse that we most often read at the Feast of Tabernacles, because it talks about a different age. But this is the way it's going to be somewhere in the future, when life will really be a life of substance for the whole world. I'm not even going to turn there. You can look it up later. But just consider this time. It shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established on the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow to it. Many nations or many people shall come and say, give me a 3D TV and maybe I'll come to church tomorrow. No, many people shall come and say, come and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, and we shall walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. We look forward to that day when we will live in a world that has spiritual substance. And we'll be able to join, and to not only join, but to lead the whole world then in keeping the feast of unleavened bread. And it will be a feast that will be life-changing, because it will be a feast of sincerity and truth.